But people don't see hymnals anymore. It looked less harmony. Well, kids
true.
Were bored
right.
sitting in services. Where did a lot of kids learn how to read music and understand harmony? It's leafing through the hymnals.
It's
if you
true.
Don't have them in the pews, you know, I like to deputize people to go break into the closets where
and
the hymnals
put
are.
Them back in.
And get them back in overnight. Do it about midnight on a Saturday night. And on Sunday, the first service, they'll be back in the pews.
And children will do that.
And they learned
because
a lot.
Yes.
Welcome to Classical Etc. You're in the studio with Memoria Press.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Classical Etc. I'm Jessica Gardner, and today I'm with Paul, Tanya, and a special guest, Professor Carol. Carol, we are so glad to have you.
I'm just pleased as punch to be here.
Carol's expertise is in music and the arts. She is a sought-after speaker, a tour guide, a musician, a writer. She's an associate professor of music history. And here at Memoria Press, we use Carol's materials in our art program. And you write quite a bit for our magazine.
That's true.
Yeah.
And our music program.
That's right.
Music.
Yes. Yes.
And she's here as a writer in residence this week, all yes. week.
Carol is
But I'm
talented.
Not going to say what she's writing because Ooh. Then people will want it. I learned that lesson the hard way. Just don't say. She's just writing. Just writing.
Forthcoming at Memoria Press.
Can I say that, Carol?
Well, it's barreling down is what it's doing. It's, yeah. it's in the barreling down stages that's, at this point. So
that's mm-hmm. good.
You are talented and an absolute delight to talk to. So Thank it's you. A privilege to have you with oh, us, Carol.
You all are so nice to everyone who comes through these doors. So thank you.
Oh, and Carol, on the podcast, we normally go around and talk about what we're reading, but since you're here, I thought we could answer what we're listening to. Can you give us just one artist that you're loving listening to right now?
Well, listening to and loving listening to are two different things.
Ooh.
And if you're in my business, you do a lot of listening to things because you need to. The same reason you do a lot of reading because
That's
you need
right.
to, because mm-hmm. it's up on your desk mm. or because something has come up and you need to check it. So a lot of listening I'm doing now is related to this thing that's barreling down. And then a couple of days ago, I spent some time listening to, from my college time, John Coltrane recordings.
Really?
In consequence to something that was said in the Cincinnati conferences. No time to go into that. But I thought, it's been a long time since I revisited his artistry. And then, you know, that list could go on and on. But there's just one thing.
Okay. Okay. Paul, how about you?
The artist that I was recently blown away by, that was a concert Sarah and I went to, of Postmodern Jukebox.
Say more.
Have you heard of this, Carol?
I'm about to hear about it.
Postmodern Jukebox is a group that they take, mostly more modern pop songs, but they'll also take things from, you know, back from the 50s and 60s, but they turn it into like 1920s style music, and they are phenomenal artists. I have not, when I saw them live in Lexington, I said, I have never seen musicians this good in person in my life.
What genre? Everything.
I mean, but what they're trying to do is turn it into like a vintage style. And so they will take, you know, anything, the Hallelujah song.
Oh.
Right? They'll turn that into it. They'll take Taylor Swift, turn that into 1920s. They'll take, you know, just about anything. Huh. Actually, I was just looking for, I was looking for the Cotton Eye Joe. They don't have the Cotton Eye Joe in vintage, but they have Old Town Road, right? Which is like a modern country song. They've got that in vintage. And they've only been around for 10 or 15 years.
How do you find it?
They do it on YouTube and they actually, their video production is phenomenal too, because they will all dress in this 1920 style. And they also, bring in tap dancers. It is beautiful to listen to. They are extremely talented and it's beautiful to watch as well.
Huh. Wow. And that was just locally? You went to a concert?
I went to a concert locally, but I think they're out of New York.
Okay.
From what I can tell, I think the actual performers are constantly changing.
Oh,
it's not like it's five people that
right.
do the same thing all the time. When they're on tour, they're pulling people from everywhere And so I think every, like I got the impression anytime I would see them perform, it would be a wholly new experience because they're just amazing. They're just very, very talented musicians that they pull in and then they go on tour and then they get new musicians.
That's interesting. Yeah. It sounds good. Hmm.
Tanya, how about you?
I'm not listening to any music because I'm listening to A Gentleman in Moscow all the time now because I'm dying to get to that that show with Ewan McGregor.
Yeah.
And I just need to get through this book again so that I can let myself watch the show. Somebody told me they thought it was really good because of the character of the Count. Because he is pulling it off.
Okay.
Which you would think he would be able to do.
Yeah.
So no music for me. Sorry. I feel like it's a huge hole in my life that I don't listen to much music. I really don't listen to much music.
It's okay.
I used to listen to music all the time.
Oh.
I've gone more to talking, listening to people talk.
Yeah.
You know, like podcasts and radio news stations. I don't know why. What's happened to me?
I don't know what's happened to you, Tanya, but I have no idea what we're talking about today, but I wanted to ask Carol a question before we get going. I once heard a person say that what he likes to do is turn up his speakers as loud as he'll go, and turn on classical music. And that really struck me, and I've done it a couple of times, and it's a phenomenal experience.
Cathartic?
Just experiencing music in a very different way than what you're used to.
But really loud.
Very, very loud, right? Because, I mean, but if you go to a theater, I mean, they're not playing this quietly.
Right.
Right? And so, I don't, what do you feel about that, Carol? Have you ever, like, when you listen to classical music, how loud is it?
Depends on whether it's Bach or Mahler, you know? I mean, I'm from the generation where the speakers were bigger than we were. You can literally take a nap in some of them if you were to lay them down or maybe stand them up, you know. And the idea of all the sound and it was a very different time. And now everybody's wearing them here, getting a version of sound. I think that's a fair statement.
Yes.
And if they're getting more than that, it's a different problem, you know. Mm-hmm. Being enveloped in sound makes more sense if you're in the physical acoustical space. And of course the music of my era with Hendrix and Joplin and all of that, Grateful Dead, you did crank it. And you cranked the Mozart up and you cranked everything up basically because it was just great sound. At a certain point, and yes, it's great. I mean, you're going to get a massage, you're going to jump into an ice cold swimming pool, you're going to envelop yourself with sound vibrations, go for it. If you really begin to talk about how loud was music in various times, how loud was the world before jet planes, for example, and everything else that happens, you know, there were always volcanoes and the cry of cattle and rocks being slashed with, you know, hammers and sledges. There was plenty of noise in pre-electronic world, but there was plenty of quiet. And the amount of musicians in an ensemble, an orchestra would be 7, 8, 9 people, you know, at a certain point in the Baroque. So with very quiet instruments, and yet everyone heard it crystal clear because the world was quieter. And music was like a flashing light. You know, you didn't just let it go by. It caught your attention. It was meant to catch your attention. So we do a lot of that with volume and flash and lighting now, when it used to be simply a function of time and place and space and acoustical waves that would reach you, and just as they do a little child, right? A little child hears a flute what does that child do, especially if their ears haven't been blown off by other things? They are completely captivated. Mm-hmm. So it all gets into a lot of factors. But if you decide to crank up any old thing and, you know, do it safely and wisely, you know, I mean, I would say go for it. I am not, I'm getting in trouble. I'm not a fan of us carrying these sound worlds down inside of our ears, and time will tell what, I mean, it's first of all, it isolates you from everything and everybody, and that's its own story.
It does.
We won't even go there right now, but in terms of the experience of hearing, and then there's hearing and listening and, you know, I was listening to you all on your
Novel Thoughts
podcast about completing versus considering versus contemplating. Mm. So there's all kinds of levels of listening to music that we could also talk about.
Sure. That's a great question.
It was very helpful to me because I realized because I was talking about very much, I wasn't thinking of earbuds at all or earphones. I was thinking like just taking like a real speaker. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of sad the other day because I wanted to do it and the girls were already asleep and I was like, I can't do this. I'm going to crank this music where it would shake the house. But I realized the reason I liked doing that was because I would just sit there in a chair and listen.
Mm, exactly.
And that's something that I rarely do. But when I've done it, I've very much appreciated doing it.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you're contemplating at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. That's something, of course, then you get into the background music versus actually listening and how do we treat music? And we are in this modern situation having these issues. If you crank back anything before the gramophone, right, or go back before the 1870s or before 1900, these questions aren't even real. They don't exist because mm-hmm. everything had to be created and you had to either be there to hear it or play it yourself.
Mm. Hmm. That's good, Carol. Huh.
Well, you asked about today's discussion. We're going to talk about the role of the arts in classical education. And Carol, I would love to hear you answer, what difference does it make in a child's education to incorporate music, to incorporate the arts? Why do we do it? What difference does it make?
Well, there's a question.
So how many hours do I have? No, or maybe I should just leave the room and let me know. I'm joking. No, I mean, well, you know, I mean, the short answer is we are given creation, the ability to create by our creator. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm always saying this, and I know it's formulaic, but it's also incredibly true. A child sings before it can speak. Mm. You know, a little child who can form no words can form a heck of a musical vocabulary at a pretty good volume with usually very nice sound.
Mm.
Not always, right? A child dances in its little, mm-hmm. whatever those little things are, we carry them around in. Mm-hmm. You know, you put on a Sousa march and that child's limbs go in pretty close rhythm mm-hmm. and with very creative movements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we reach for something beautiful the minute that the eyes can sort of focus on a prism or lace or fluff or whatever, or light. What does a child do? Instinctively reaches. So if you take just those three things, which is really dance and music and art and whatever else you want to put in there, you see the complete picture of who we are as creative beings. Mm-hmm. And we foster that when they're little and we buy all the crayons and the markers and we step on the tops and we, mm-hmm. you know, we play all the wonder. Hopefully we play all these great classic children's songs, folk songs, hymns. We sing. And they sing and we sing and we get the bells and we... Mm. And then you get a certain age and everybody decides it's an elective.
Mm.
And, you know, and then away it goes, like in that closet. And if we get time, we'll open the door and bring you out for half an hour air once every 2 weeks. And that's the great battle. And it feels a little funny saying that in a manner, because I'm in a presence of people all through this building whose hearts and souls and minds and effort are dedicated to reviving the most beautiful and true things. And boy, you're doing it, you know? Mm. But then there's this issue of the music and the arts. So I'm here and I'm tugging at people.
Yes.
And there's a wonderful response so far.
Mm. Yeah.
What would you say to a parent who might be listening, thinking, that sounds awesome. I would love my child to experience that, but I don't have a background in the arts. I feel unqualified. How would you answer that?
Well, unless you're a professional musician, that's probably what you're going to come to, or someone in the family is. Again, that's a modern question because there used to be music around.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, people played, people sang, you had the church choirs, they played and sang good repertoire, there was a good organist. You know, if you had the means and it wasn't like paying for tickets now, you know, I mean, there access to music was much more natural. Mm-hmm. And in my time, everybody took piano or you took trumpet or you took something. You may not have to do it for more than a couple of years, but by golly, Ned, we used to call, you know, 3:15 to 3:45 was practice time. I mean, you could walk up and down the streets and if the windows were open, you know, you'd hear people practicing. They got that done. Just as we say, you'll eat broccoli, you'll take a bath, you know, and you will learn some proficiency on an instrument. So mm-hmm. we're not in that era anymore. And parents do feel unconfident and it does seem elite and it is seem to price itself out. I have a lot of things that I like to suggest in talks about about getting to live music in ways that don't break budgets, like taking advantage of high school orchestras, middle school bands and orchestras and choirs and community choirs and things that are really quite high level in most places. And the music you hear at a crafts fair, the music that they go to what we used to call old folks' homes, you know, the communities where there's all kinds of people who were incredibly proficient on their instruments, and nobody wants to hear them sing or play anymore, you know. And there's just endless things you can do that aren't formal, that aren't expensive, that are real, that will kind of have heart to heart, not just note to ear, if you know what I mean. But the thing is, you don't have to really reinvent the wheel. Curricula approaches ways that music and art, if you want to call it music history, music appreciation, art history, they've been taught for a very long time. And there's very simple principles. And the hard part is that you're weaving everything you have and know into it, or you don't have the real product. And that's also what's so liberating about it. It is, again, nothing that is in isolation. If you can set it down in the middle of the table and watch it grow. Which I know sounds very poetic, so what does that really mean? But the first thing you have to do is decide that it matters.
Right, and then you can just listen. I mean, if you can't do anything else, at least just listen. You know, in our classrooms, every day when the students are doing their copy work or just quiet seat work, like math seat workers, you know, there is classical music playing in the background, and that is, we're not making them memorize it. We're not making them really do, we talk about the composer and we talk about the piece of music and a little history behind it, but it's really just for helping them gain an appreciation for it. And it's very, you know, it's a very simple thing to do. It's, and you all have, you, Professor Carroll has courses that people can take, and we're all working toward courses for younger students too, so that, because it is a whole, we have to admit it's a whole. It's like the final thing that we haven't dealt with yet.
At the press.
The necessity for the fine arts in a classical curriculum, that, and they're just, the resources aren't the same as they are. You know, there are so many Latin resources now, but we are limited in resources. They're out there, but there will be more.
Yes, there will.
Well, and I mean, in the grand scheme of classical education, right? Like if we're, you know, so uber focused on truth and goodness, right? Like the fine arts is, I mean, we're finding beauty everywhere, but fine arts is where it's uniquely contemplated, right? And so it really needs to be there.
Well, like my children would never have been in a choir, much less a Latin choir, but they were forced to be because it was a requirement. Cheryl did not make it optional. It was a requirement. And it was a huge gift to them.
Really?
Because they learned a lot about music. They had to sing every year for 10 years. And it did give them a great appreciation for good music. And for my oldest son loves like soundtracks from Lord of the Rings and
something cinematic.
I can't remember that guy's name.
John Williams.
He's done so many. Is that right, John Williams?
And you're talking about a lot of different things. The pedagogy that you use for everything you do and the hard things that you do, that all the parents are doing, right? All the tutors are doing. It's the same pedagogy. It's first of all, it has to be conveyed with passion and love. And there are ways to do that, even if you don't quite have that to offer, okay? Then it's repetition. And you cannot take on the whole world. You don't start with your third graders and dump, you know, Plato, Aristotle, and here's some Dante too.
Right.
Get on it, you know. You find it's tasting, it's experiencing, and it's repetition. And it's amazing. Children are happy with the repetition of something.
Love the repetition.
They love to recognize something. They love, and you know, that double-edged sword of the internet, which is something I rant about. And then I am grateful for because of what is able to be accessed, right? means that really and truly, and forget that, the CDs, forget that. Go into any thrift store, any Goodwill, for 20 cents to 50 cents, you can pick up the most marvelous recorded materials now. CDs, no one wants. LPs, nobody wants. Cassettes, nobody wants. You know, and it's you can build a music library for nothing. They'll probably just hand you a box if you'll take it, you know. And so there are just fantastic resources, mm-hmm. not to mention all these performances that are filmed, not to mention master classes in the class I teach for Memoria Academy, which is, I forget what we call it, has a nice name for a scene for high schoolers. And I could give them lots of lists of things to listen to, but I'm inclined to direct them to certain filmed master classes where the master teacher is working with a very fine player or singer on an important piece of literature. And you have that, you know, kind of like being in a blender, really, or a food processor, you know, that goes on for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 minutes. And they are intense. And they come out well, or they wouldn't be online to watch. You know, they pick the good ones. But really, what I find that when students with not having a background in the arts watch this go on, they're flabbergasted. Because they've never thought about the fact that music has to be not just learned, but coached and formed and shaped and beaten out to the point where it, like gold, you know, dross turned into the finest separated, you know, the end. So it's there's a lot of real blood, sweat, and tears in music.
There is. You know, and that's another thing people can do too is private music lessons. Mm-hmm. Pick an instrument. Let your child pick an instrument. I picked piano for my kids because I felt like If they knew the piano first, then they could really go from there to anything, any other instrument. But I felt like they needed it. But my youngest son refused to do piano and went straight to the drums at the age of 8, which he's still playing. Mm-hmm. But it was those just that individual working one-on-one with a teacher is a huge help.
Yeah, and I mean, I would support the. You just like the child just has to not have a choice, and you've got to pick an instrument, right?
That's right.
My older sisters both learned piano, but for whatever reason, I don't know if my mom got tired out when it came to me. I did not learn the piano, and then when I went to a school in eighth grade, it was everybody has to have an instrument and be in the band. And I said,
"So you were forced."
Well, I said, "What's the easiest one?" And I was told trumpet, and so I played trumpet.
How did that go?
That's not.
I know. The options were clarinet, saxophone, trumpet, trombone. I mean, the drum was already taken, and so I mean, those are the ones that are coming to mind. And they were like, "Trumpet's the easiest." I was like, "Okay, fine." And I learned to play the trumpet.
Right, and you learned to read music because you were.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes, absolutely. That was a big deal. And then we were also forced to be in the choir, so you had to learn how to sing. And so you did harmonies, doing those. Mm-hmm. I mean, that teaches you so much. But I never would have chosen to do it.
Hmm. And you've got a new music. Is it a theory?
Hank, yeah, I wrote the. It's a theory book that assumes you can't read music necessarily.
Right. So
I think we put it from about age 12 up or something like that. And it'll take you all the way to what we call tonic dominant harmony. And it's Hank is a theorist and it's very clear. It's very orderly.
And Hank and I looked and we're going to sell it. I just haven't gotten around to ordering it. But Hank and I looked at it alongside our new music, how to read music course, which he said he felt like would come first, like for younger students, fourth grade.
Yes,
so we are getting more there for students that or parents that really want their students to know how to read music and to know a little bit about music theory, too.
Gotcha. But if I may, two things. One is just reading music. It seems so hard, and it kind of, I've done it since I was little, so it's not fair to say, but in the work I do in the world of touring through Smithsonian Journeys, I'm with people who are, let's call them eminently successful senior adults like me, I'm in that age group. And they're people that have gone all over the world and accomplished all kinds of things. Very often, their regret is they never learned to read music. And I kind of want to go, okay.
It's too late.
Five lines and four spaces, and they can do spreadsheets that would go across this property, But so there's a sense that it's hard. And it gets that well, gets that's perpetuated because
when you look at it, it looks hard.
It looks hard. You don't start with looking at Mahler, you know. You start by looking at a line of chant in a choir.
But even if you look in like a hymnal every Sunday, it's going to look hard.
But people don't see hymnals anymore. It looked less hard when kids were bored sitting in services. Where did a lot of kids learn how to read music and understand harmony? So leafing through the hymnals. If you don't have them in the pews, you know, I like to deputize people to go break into the closets where the hymnals are and get them back in overnight. Do it about midnight on a Saturday night, and on Sunday the first service they'll be back in the pew.
And children will do that,
and they learned a lot.
Yes, I remember doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Just leaf through it.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
And I don't remember when it dawned on me, but all of a sudden when I went from a hymnal that just had the melody to a hymnal that had the harmonies.
Oh.
And I was like, wait, what's this? You know, and then that's actually really intimidating if your first experience looking at musical notation has all four harmonies in there.
I'm really sad that we don't have hymnals anymore. I didn't realize what a loss that was for children.
Oh, dear. Oh, good.
I had never thought about it before.
You've got a key, though, right?
Well, I know where the hymnals are.
But no, I'm serious. I go nuts on this topic, and I don't want to go nuts.
But you're right.
It's an elegant audience, right? I don't want to do that. But seriously, you say it looked intimidating, but what if your family, and I know not everybody can just say, oh, we'll do this tonight. I've got that. But if children used to grow up hearing their family members singing in four-part harmony, because it's actually a pretty natural thing.
Not in my family.
True, but it is a pretty natural thing. And you get that if you go to camps.
Or you go into camp.
Different styles of music, bluegrass, country music. There's a great deal of harmonizing, you know?
Yeah. So I love harmonizing. Yeah. I think it sounds great, but my family would never do that.
Yeah, well, we'll talk later.
It's a different kind of art to enjoy.
Not
Charlton
going to happen.
We have therapy sessions for this. You do know that. You may not like how they go, but
no.
Carol, we talk about truth, beauty, and goodness. Focusing on the beauty piece, is all art beautiful?
No.
Can you say more about that? How do we know?
Well, it wasn't art that was crying prophetically at the onset that artists could see of the First World War was not written for you and for me in this day to decide whether we think it's beautiful or not. Mm. You know, I mean, art has messages. Mm. It has standards. Those just as food from area to area changes, you know, just as architectural style and fashion have changed. So there is extraordinary beauty in the arts, in melody and harmony and expression of orchestral color. I mean, you could go on and on and on as wide as the ocean to talk about that. But do remember that artists are not the best, especially everyday people. They are given a task, I would call it generally a divine task, to state something. And you may not like what they state. Hmm. And they could be wrong. And they can overstate. And they can lose their way. Like a novelist can lose his or her
way, right? That's right.
But artists, and they can be pretty strange people, me too. But they have their ear to the ground, especially painters, especially visual artists, and they hear things that the rest of us do not hear. I am convinced of that. Mm-hmm. And when they put it out in art, for an example, the whole expressionist movement in the late 19th century, especially in Vienna and other places, in Germany, coming out in Northern Europe, I love that art. Is that art beautiful? Absolutely not. You have to decide what you're going to show to younger children, although some of it can be kind of fun for them too, you know. But what were these people doing? They were proclaiming that the whole world was about to fall apart and explode, which indeed it did. Hmm. And did anyone heed their message? So again, I'm saying that again, and I'll say it again, not maybe right now, but we have to look at the era of the art. Art responds to the tenor of its times. If you're in Bach's time or in Monteverdi's time and your patron is the elegant, whichever person it is, prince or merchant or prince or whatever, you write what is required. Why else would Haydn write 104 trios for this strange instrument called the baritone, which his patron, Esterházy, played, which is just a kind of a sitar meets a cello and goes crazy. You know, it's a beautiful sound. People actually still play it. It's kind of having a little revival. But his count loved it and was good at it. So, you know, it's just like somebody needs a meal, somebody needs a trio. And so, you know, artists respond to many things, the desires of the patron, the needs, what instruments they have, what they can work with. You can go on and on and on. And that's why asking a very valid question of, is all art beautiful? And the sub question of that, and if not, what do we do about it?
Yeah.
Or how do we present it? And how much history and how much explanation and how much of its power do we let out? At what age for what children? Mm. You know, that's really the complete question there. And you do need to understand the era, the times, the means, the demands, and the messages.
I feel like that's true with literature too, that you need that context. But I know there are people who think that you should go into a piece of literature with absolutely no context and just let it speak to you as it is and not try to think about, you know, what times the author was living in or what the author might have been trying to do with it, but just how it speaks to you. And I think you're missing so much if you don't have the context, if you don't know some of the things that are really like the art itself is the result of something major.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that the way you describe that, but I'd love to know who these artists are.
Which ones?
You've got to show me the ugly art.
The expressionist
as an example.
Who are the artists in the expressionist?
Well, Emil Nolde is an interesting
one. I don't even know that. I've never looked at expressionist art.
You maybe have seen the cover of a volume and you went, oh, I don't think I need to buy that.
It could be.
You know?
But Carol, I love the way you phrased it though. You said, I love that art, but is it beautiful? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important distinction for everybody, mm-hmm. right? Like there can be something that is important and that is worthwhile contemplating that doesn't fit the objective standards of beauty and proportion and harmony and all, you know, all those things, but still deserves a place at the table, still deserves to be known.
Well, and what about the question of, is it classical? We have to decide, you know, because in most cases, these artists were trained. In most cases, they knew, you know, there's still form, there's still a focal point, there's still the elements of line, there's still, you know, color and all of the ingredients of painting in the last 300-500 years, right? And perspective, or deliberately upsetting these things, which is what abstract art does later especially in the moving into the middle of the 20th century. Again, it's fascinating. Actually, that's what makes it art so interesting. If it were all staid and beautiful, you could take care of it in, I don't know, a week and it would be done.
Do you like Picasso?
Do I like Picasso?
Mm-hmm.
I like a lot of people way more than Picasso. Picasso was a very good marketer. And I mean, I don't, you know, my problem with Picasso, as if Picasso would care, is that that name has become the everything that we know. And it's just sort of ruled out everybody, just scattered everybody, as if there were one writer.
Right.
In a period of about 50, 40 years, you know. And that is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good enough answer?
It is. I just wondered. I like Picasso and don't know why.
Oh, well.
Because it doesn't feel like something I should like.
You love or you loathe? Which
I like him.
Oh, like.
I
okay,
like
well then,
a lot of Picasso's
well, we need to talk.
Art, but I don't know why. I feel like I shouldn't.
Oh,
because it's so modern and it doesn't really make
modern.
Good sense. Well, it feels
it's
modern.
Like, how can it feels, modern
well, it's all well, geometric.
Picasso also had different stages in his life, right?
Right.
Like,
and I'm talking about like the the cubism and the
angular.
It's very simple and I feel like I should be able to paint those things.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, but I just think, is that real art?
Well,
just all those geometric shapes. I mean, couldn't anybody do that? But I like it.
Well,
I find myself just looking at it.
Well, you're ripe for a whole lot.
I'm struggling with my love of Picasso.
Oh, no. You shouldn't. It's begging you to widen your experience. You know, you have now tasted, once cloves. Now think
maybe
what else is out there.
Right,
oh, we
I
can
don't
fill
know.
You up with names. I'm starting to write them down. Kandinsky, Gonchara.
Last time I did a podcast with you, you were going to send me a CD of classical music to listen to so I could develop a love for it, but I never got it.
Uh-oh.
So therefore, I have not yet developed that love.
Oh, dear.
While we're asking Carol for things, I would like a Spotify list of folk songs for children.
I don't I don't even have
Spotify.
Well, do you have, we're a list and we could make the list.
Right? Well, we have a book, list. You know.
I know you have a book.
With 100 traditional songs called Hurrah and Hallelujah.
I know. I need to get the book and I need to make a Spotify list. Mm-hmm.
Does that come with an audio accompaniment?
Okay. No.
But you could find them probably free
online. It's because of the royalties. Yeah. It's hard to do it. You can't really. It's hard to do it.
You can't. You can't get this stuff. Right. Except a great deal of it is Library of Congress and Smithsonian.
So you can find it.
So you can, and in many ways. I mean, that's the thing. And that's why, you know, we started out with Discovering Music having a CD, and that was great when we started.
Yes.
It was fabulous. But people, we're so much more is available. But yeah, no, let's curate that list, except hold me to it this time. you know. Well, yeah.
I'm still waiting on the last one. I feel like it'll come.
I kind of don't remember that special moment the way you do.
I think I was just saying, you know, I just don't have really an appreciation for or know anything about classical music. I've never listened to it seriously. And so you were going to convert me.
All right. Well, let's start with the visual
with
art.
Picasso?
No, not Picasso.
I'm already converted.
I know. No,
I just don't understand
it. Well, okay. We have our work cut out. I can see that.
I feel like we've queued ourselves up for another podcast next time Carol's back.
Next steps for every
How we convert, Tanya from a Picasso lover to...
to Goncharova and Kandinsky and Larionov and a bunch of wonderful artists.
I have not heard of those people even. But
you're going to be
But Picasso is not my true favorite. My true favorite is really Van Gogh. Mm. I really love the brightness of his pictures, of his paintings. And I went to the Dorsey in Paris, and then I went to the British Museum, and I've been to the National Gallery, and everywhere I go, the first thing I look for is the Van Gogh room.
Did you go to the traveling exhibit when it was here?
I did not because I thought that just seemed like 3D. I don't know. Maybe it would have been great. Did you go?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Did you think it was great?
It was different than I thought. It was different. But for what it was, I enjoyed it.
Right.
It was cool.
I probably would have, but it just, I don't know.
It's funny to me that you like Van Gogh for the brightness. Like I like Caravaggio for the darkness. Because what is light in those paintings is very like what he wants you to focus on is very apparent.
Right.
But when you said light, I was like, oh, that's interesting.
I really think that's why I like Picasso, because it's simple and light and it feels airy or something to me. Happy. It feels happy. Carol, you don't know what to do now.
No, I don't. There's not much I can add to that. And the main thing is that you love it, and that you love it, and you know why you love it, and that's one direction that is now yours, right? Mm-hmm. That has meaning from which you can build if you choose or not. You know.
Do you have a favorite artist? Every time you see a painting by that person. And
I'm
you think,
terribly fond of the Russian 19th century ones. And Nikolai Gay, G.E. That's a good short name for you. Mm. His works just bowl me over. Mm. And many of them are on sacred subjects, but with that gritty, gutty, or gutsy, I should say, maybe gutty, Russian brush, that eye for realism and intense color, just literally a master photography before there was really such a thing like that. I mean, photography was here, but nobody was. It's just stunning what psychologically as well. So I might have to say that. I'll just say that right now. I mean, I could give you someone else, but that'll do.
No, that'll
and
do.
And it's really whatever I'm working on, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that when you're reading, right? When you're reading on a Karenina or when you're reading Dickens. It's
my favorite book changes all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right, as it should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what's great about it because it's dynamic.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing from our conversation, Carol, is that would you say to someone who wants to grow in appreciating the arts, one good first step might be identify what you actually like and just explore that. Find more artists like it.
Yes. And if you're not sure what that could look like. I'm really serious. Go down to a Goodwill, a thrift store, a library sale, an estate sale. Do you know how many people spent a lot of their money because it was expensive to buy these folio books? I did a lot of that. I look at what's on my shelves and I can't even imagine how much money I took out of, you know, off the top to get things that I have. Mm. And people don't want them.
Mm. Oh,
I
really?
I mean, I have gone into a state, you've got to get, you know, look for maybe the right neighborhoods or the right age of house. And people have shelves and shelves. It's kind of like their National Geographics, if you will, you know. Mm-hmm. And they would be thrilled if you just took them.
Oh.
I mean, you know, if they've checked eBay, they might know that some of them have some value. But get folio volumes and put them all over the house. If something happens to them, so what? Because they were going in a dumpster.
Right.
You see?
Right.
It's kind of like the hymn books, you know?
Yes.
And so let them be around. Let the kids look at them. If they mark in them, that's not the worst. So what? In a way. I mean, depending, you know? Yeah. But let them have them along with their storybooks. I mean, look in there maybe a bit. But depends. But, you know, I mean, art had a different, you know, okay, we won't go, that's a different podcast. But just have, because as magnificent as the internet is, you don't get a sense of the texture. You can't, I mean, folios can't completely convey that. Big, beautiful color pictures don't come much closer to giving you a sense of the
real
effect
thing.
And the textures.
That's right.
And then, of course, and the other thing to do is go to pawn shops or stores and buy paintings. Mm. People have these wonderful paintings. They don't have to be replicas of the old masters, but they're actual paintings, you know? And they have the impasto paint. They have the you can feel and see the paint. It's probably dusty, but that's okay. You can blow it off, you know? And you can hang them up and you can put them in the hallway and they can and they have beautiful frames. Again, you go down the rescue mission where we live and their frames are selling these paintings for $5. And the frames, if you went to buy the frames, they'd be, I can't even imagine what the cost would be. Hmm. So there's a lot of things people can get at a very low cost. And it's interesting to set your kids loose doing that kind of thing.
Yes. I took my kids to the Speed Museum when the Rembrandt exhibit came through years ago. They were probably 8 and 11, something like that. And everybody was very quiet looking through. And all of a sudden, my 8-year-old said, "This is so boring." Right in the middle of it. And then we just kept on going through. I shushed him and we kept on going through and I was forcing them to look at Rembrandt. And then I was like, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. These paintings will not come back here. And then we go to another room and it wasn't Rembrandt. I can't remember who the artist was, but it was a picture of David with Goliath's head on a stick. And they stood there forever. They loved that painting. And they were like, now this is cool. And I thought, okay, I'm done with art museums.
That's perfect. You were just, and if Rembrandt had painted that, they would have liked it.
They would have, but not because of the quality of the painting.
Yeah, but even just sitting there contemplating it, over time, you just get used to looking at it, and then you start seeing more things. And as you get older, you start seeing more things. Right. And
but you know, Rembrandt's dark. Do you like Rembrandt?
Dark, yeah. Mm-hmm. I do like him.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, Carol, thanks for being on with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate that. It's wonderful to be with you all. I listen to you all the time in my kitchen. You feel as if you live in a corner on the cabinet there.
And now you know where we live.
I do. I do indeed. Thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
Yes. And we look forward to what is in the works. And we can find all of your writings for the magazine at memoriapress.com if you're interested. I was just reading some of your articles this week. Refreshing. And they're so good. And you also have a website, ProfessorCarol.com.
That's correct.
So some of the resources we've mentioned you can find there and at MemoriaPress.com. And thanks for joining us. We will be back next time.
Thank you for joining us today on Classical Etc. by Memoria Press. If you like what you heard, you can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about Memoria Press, please go to memoriapress.com. This has been Classical Etc. We're so glad you joined us, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Memoria Press Podcast Network, providing a classical Christian perspective on the world of education. To learn more about Memoria Press, visit us at memoriapress.com. To connect with us, find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.